So I'll be taking you through the introduction today, and Eleanor will take you through the part three delivery and assessments, as well as the program structure. And we have Anthony taking you through the exam technique as chief examiner. And we also have the various prize winners taking you through the part three journey. And we have, you know, Sarah, Mike, Amanda, and Steve taking you through the changes to the education program. So, how is part three different to a university? So the first one is work-life balance. You do have various commitments in your life, and that is personal, professional, and your learning commitments as well. And something that is a struggle as a new sort of part three student, something that we recommend you doing to address this is to sort of discuss any sort of eligibility that you may have at your workplace, whether that be study leave or flexible working arrangements. That could definitely contribute a lot in terms of helping you sort of juggle and sort of plan your day. The next one is less contact with others. So at a university, it is a campus setting, so you do meet a lot of people more frequently at lecturers, tutorials. Although in the Part 3 program, we have tutorials 3 times a semester, but it's only hosted here in Sydney. And we do have students across the world who may not be able to join. So the classes are smaller than the usual sort of tutorials that we have at university. Something to sort of help you, build your network and sort of like meet other people is form study groups through the learning management system that we have. There is that sort of online discussion forum where you're able to sort of see other people who have enrolled into a course and sort of initiate to form study groups. And, do encourage you to attend the tutorials on site here in this exact room, just because you do meet people in person as well as those joining over the phone as well. And as well at your work, I mean, that's a given there. You do have a greater independence in terms of your study, so therefore you do have that sort of responsibility. You don't have, a lecturer sort of like pushing you in terms of telling you where to sort of focus your studies. We do have that sort of support through the tutors here, but it is sort of slightly different, and we do sort of expect that you do take that sort of responsibility in terms of proactiveness in your learning. I guess prioritization is also really important to sort of help you sort of help you be a little bit more responsible with your learning. And that is, for example, 3 sort of things that I do is, you know, assess the risk and consequences if you don't sort of complete that task, the length of the task in terms of how long it would take you to complete it, and the time sensitivity. So those are the 3 principles that I go by in terms of prioritizing my time and my task. That's just a little tip there for you. The other one is obviously everything that I've mentioned there does increase your sort of pressure. And I strongly recommend that you do set up like a study routine, just because once you get into a routine, it's better in terms of juggling your tasks and your learning, as well as your other sort of personal commitments. Other differences is that it is the part three exam is like open book, so you are free and welcome to sort of bring in materials to sort of help you sort of prep your responses for the questions. It is also computer based. I know that most universities are still sort of paper based, so that's something just for noting. And it's held at Clifton's. That's our venue that we use. Another one that's very important to note is that we do assess based on, you know, critical thinking as well as complex judgment. So, you know, you don't sort of like regurgitate things in your responses, and yeah, according to your memory. That's very different in terms of university in part three. So who are the part three students? We have over 400 enrollments every semester, and majority of them are located in Australia. We do have students who are based in Asia, Europe, as well as in America, but it just depends. Every semester is different in terms of the students that we get. Obviously, majority of them are doing life insurance and general insurance. That's more of the traditional area, but, you know, we do have new emerging areas sort of coming, you know, light in the profession, like data analytics. And most people have completed their parts 1 and 2, which is sort of reflected here in the room from what I can tell as well. Majority of our students also spend approximately or more 20 plus hours per week studying Part 3, just because it is a lot more self-directed and more proactive. And I do strongly recommend that you do dedicate 20 hour plus. The average time to complete Part 3 is approximately 3 years, but however, that's dependent on you, you know, passing that in your first go as well. And approximately every year we get 60 to 80 fellows. Something that I just want to raise here is that we do have a newly established student committee, and we're currently seeking Part 3 students. So if you're studying Part 3 this semester, please feel free to look at this ad that I have here, the link. It's on our ACTRES website under the Volunteers Vacancies webpage. If you're interested, please send through your CV by close of business next Friday. We are looking for Part 3 students to join this committee. This committee is about bridging that sort of gap between university and the institute. Do we have any questions before I hand you over to Eleanor, who will talk about the Part 3 delivery in the program? Okay, Eleanor.
Well, thank you, Karina, for the introduction. So my name is Eleanor Mazando, and I'm the education manager. I'll most probably be the person that you'll interact the most with throughout the semester, along with Orsa, who is the education coordinator. You will get a lot of emails from her and reminders and that sort of thing. And I'm just going to go through how Part 3 is delivered. Right. So our main sort of hub or center of where the activity is for Part 3 is in the learning management system. So for those of you, most of you should have access at the moment to the learning management system. It's usually given to you about 2 or 3 days after you enroll. So if anyone doesn't have their access or is having trouble accessing that, please feel free to contact us. The email address is there at the bottom. So what can you find in the learning management system? So that's where the news forum is, which is the main sort of way that we'll be contacting you through the post in the news forum. So anything, any information about what's coming up in the semester, any reminders about tutorials, or anything that we need to let you know about will be done through the news forum. So all of you are subscribed to that automatically when you're enrolled into the LMS. You'll also find a calendar of all the upcoming events, so tutorial dates, reminders about when assignments are due and that sort of thing are all in the LMS. This is where you access the participation discussion forum. So when I go through the assessment, I'll talk in a little more detail about that. Course notes and readings, so all the soft copies of course notes and readings are available for you to access in the LMS. And you can also have access to past assignments, tutorial presentations. So past tutorials from last semester and the semesters before. I think we go back 4 years, if I'm not mistaken. And the video links are up there. The presentations that were used for those are up there, as well as the materials. So for module 2 and 3, you also get access to 3 tutorials per semester. We've recently added that for module 1 as well, which is ST9 ERM. And there is information available about that in the LMS. So this is just a picture of what it looks like. So if you've had access, you should be able to navigate that, and that's where everything is. So I'm just going to go through some of the Part 3 policies and procedures that we have in place to support you guys. A lot of this information is readily available on the website, but I'll just speak to some things that obviously maybe you haven't come across and let you know where they are. So obviously first and most important is about academic honesty. You're coming into the profession, and it's important for all of us when you submit your work, when how you conduct yourself is obviously governed through the code of professional conduct. So we ask you guys to get familiar with that. We ask you all to read it. For those who've attended the professionalism course, some of you will have gone through that already. But we do ask you to remind yourself of that, because with obviously assessing assessments and everything, we always refer back to this. We have a fee relief policy in place. Most of you are most probably already enrolled and you've already completed your enrollment, but this is just for general information. So there is some eligibility criteria for that, which we have online, but it can, if you do meet that eligibility criteria, you can be granted 50% off of the enrollment fee. So for those who are interested in dates and things around, if you know, withdrawing from subjects. So as the semester goes on, we do understand that people have work commitments, different things come up. We have people moving to different offices and that sort of thing. We do have a form available for you online, but there are certain dates that you can withdraw from courses by. So as we get closer to exams, the refund amount or how much we'll return to you does reduce just because of how long you've been in the semester. So please familiarize yourself with those dates as well. So if you think maybe something is going to happen, the earlier that you get to us, the better. And you let us know that you might not be able to make it through the semester or maybe sit the exam. When you enrolled, we did ask you all to choose an exam center. So we have a couple of different ways that you can sit the exams. You can sit at our standard exam centers, which are sort of located in all the main cities here in Australia. And then we have a couple overseas in the big areas. But if you did not find an exam center available for you on the when you were enrolling, we will be in touch with you about setting up a temporary exam center. So what that involves is basically you will be allowed to sit that exam outside of the normal exam centers, and we look for a fellow to supervise you. You will sit at the same time as all the candidates, but you will just be sitting in a different location. If perhaps there's only one of you sitting in Hong Kong, that sort of thing, or you can't get to a standard exam center. So we will also just be in touch with any students who have not chosen an exam center or have possibly chosen an exam center where there's only one person sitting. We also have an access arrangements policy available. So if you know, you hurt your leg or that sort of thing and you can't access the center, we ask you just to send that in to us if there's any sort of special arrangements that you need to be able to access the exam center on the exam day. And then we have a special consideration policy that is available in regards to exams and assessments. And this is if there is anything that any special circumstances that you need for the exam center. And following exams or following assessments, this is if there's anything that you need the examiners to be aware of. So the special consideration, I'll give you some examples as to what it can pertain to. So if it comes to assessments, if you think you're going to be late and you're not going to meet the deadline to submit your assignment or assessment, we ask that you submit this and not just, you know, bring it in late, because then you'll be penalized for that. So if you know that something has happened or, you know, and you know that you're not going to be able to get in on time, we ask you to submit a special consideration. And around exams, this is if there's any need for a change to an exam center. So if you need a special chair or if anything in terms of you're not feeling well and you maybe need to take regular breaks throughout the exam, we do need to be aware of that. So any conditions that change the normal exam environment, we ask you to submit a special consideration application. And it's also used after exams if there's anything that you want the examiners to be aware of as to anything that happened in the exam center or how you set your exams. Exam performance interviews pertain to after the exams. So once the exams are finished, there's also an eligibility criteria for this. You can apply for an exam performance interview, and this is an opportunity to sit with the examiners, go through your exam sitting. They go through your paper with you, and they let you know how you performed and, you know, areas for improvement and that sort of thing. So all these things are available on the website. They're in the education session of the website, just where the forms are. Right, so throughout the semester, you'll be given a unique identification, which is your candidate number, and that will be coming to you in about week 5. We ask that for all your assignments and assessments, this is the number you use, that you do not put your name there. If you have to submit something, you know, written by or anything, we ask you to use your candidate number. That will be your unique identifier, as well as for exams. And so when you get your exam permit, that will be the number that will be available for you. So we ask you to be familiar with that number. And when we get to exams and that sort of thing, we'll not be using your member ID anymore. We'll usually be referring to you just by this candidate number. Do we have any questions on that yet? Or? Do you have a question on that?
No.
Oh, okay. All right, so I'm just going to go through the assessments and the different components of that and then just give you sort of a high level as to what's involved for that. The more detailed will come from our chief examiner who's here in the room, who can give you a little bit of perspective as to what they're looking for when they're assessing the candidates. So for those of you who are completing Module 1 which is either ERM or health. This is just the breakdown of what's involved with those subjects. So for ERM, the accessible part, the exam, makes up 100% of the assessment, and then you have to attend the ERM workshop. So to complete ERM, you have to do both of those components. You don't have to do them in the same semester, so if you want to sit the exam in this semester and then attend the workshop in the following semester, you can do that. There's a discussion forum for that that's in the LMS, where we have a tutor who comes on for 6 weeks just prior to the exam, and he's available for chats once a week and tutorials as well, just to support you in your studies. That is non-assessed, so ERM is the only way that's non-assessed. And for health, the exam also makes up 100% of the assessment, and then there is an online health course to complete for that. For modules 2 and 3, which are made up of the following courses, there is an online participation mark, which is 10% of the mark, and the exam, which makes up 90% of the assessment. For module 4 CAP, it's slightly different. There is a residential course component, which all first-time students have to attend. There is the post-course assignment, which makes up 20% of the assessment mark, and the exam that makes up 80%. So for the exam for modules 2 and 3, this makes up 90% of the assessment mark, like I said. It's a 3-hour exam, and you're given 15 minutes of planning and reading time. Usually in the planning and reading time, you're not allowed to type anything. It's just mainly handwriting and making notes on the paper. It's done in open book conditions. We also provide you with all the course material in soft copy, so you don't have to bring that much material with you to the exam. But obviously your own personal notes and that sort of thing, that, you know, notes that you've made up and marked up, you're welcome to bring those with you. We will send out, obviously, instructions on how the exam conditions and different things, calculators that you can bring in and that sort of thing. The exam is conducted, like we said before, via computer, so it's MS Word and Excel, and sometimes we do get students just wanting to understand what version and that sort of thing, so you're welcome to email us at the education team if you want to understand any of that, if it helps you in preparing for the exam sitting. The access to the internet is blocked throughout the exam, and like I just said, standard digital materials are all provided for you. So the online discussion forum, that's located in the LMS, and that makes up 10% of the assessment mark. So this is just a little bit of what's required for that. So candidates are required to make 6 posts. That's just the minimum. So you can make more than that if you feel, you know, you've got 10 in you, you're most welcome to do that. This is just a guideline. Obviously, in courses that are quite big, it's difficult if everyone is making a post of 500 words to be able to read that all. For everybody to be able to go through that, it makes it quite challenging. So we do set some guidelines around the word limit. It's not limited to that. Like if you feel like, you know, you need to express a little more, you're welcome to do that. But we ask you to obviously try and limit that as much as possible so that everybody can also participate, be able to give feedback on posts, be able to get through the posts as well. So two of those six posts must be original posts. That is, you initiate a discussion. And then 4 posts, you also have to respond to others. So we encourage you to post throughout the semester and not all leave it till the end, because obviously for marking as well, that makes it difficult. If you leave it until the end, topics are taken. So we do ask you to post regularly and post throughout the semester and also participate quite regularly in discussions with others. It helps people to hear other people's point of view. So this will obviously be online for you, and this just gives you an outline of what is looked for when they're marking the forum participation. This is the guide that they go by. So as it says, you know, they look at the communication of how you do it. If you've met the standard, of course, that's the beginning, and then how you discuss those issues and how you assist other people as well. So I'm pretty sure Anthony's going to cover this, and some of our prize panel here will also cover it. So do not underestimate the importance of that 10%. I know a lot of people are, well, bulk of it is in the exam, but, you know, I've sat in meetings where we're talking about results at the end, and unfortunately a person can actually fail just based on missing it by a few marks from this participation. So I encourage you guys to get into it, you know, to obviously participate with the participation mark. And that's just a little bit of a summary from semester one there, that the proportion of the students. So we talked about having about, I think last semester we had about 480 students, so only 46 got the full marks of the 10 out of 10. And for semester one, course 2A had the lowest participation average, followed by course 2B. So that's just a little bit of a summary of how many people are in the subjects and the different marks. So the averages, you can see at the bottom there, course 2A had the lowest average. But course 5A and 5B actually regularly has most of them in receiving 10 full marks as a subject. So finally, before I hand over to Anthony, this is just a quick outline of the pass rates for the past, I thought we went with 5 years, we've gone to six, the past 6 years. It is a bit of a sobering thought, but we're obviously, you know, we're here to support you and encourage you, and we are looking for those bars to just keep going up. So for semester, for the last semester, semester 1, 2008, we're at 32. So next, we're going to have Anthony, who's going to give you the chief examiner's view, and then he'll be followed by some of our prize winners from the first semester to give you their view and what's helped them as well.
Thank you. For that previous slide, you'd be surprised how much effort we try and put into how to get those bars further up. It's a real struggle when we're going through the marking process of trying to get a candidate over the line. And hopefully I can give you some ideas about how to try and maximise your chances of getting there, because I've been involved with the examination process for a fair while. I was chair of the Board of Examiners a while back and been involved in life insurance for a long time. Possibly I qualified before some of you were born. Back in the old days when we did two specialist and two ordinary subjects. And yes, as you talked earlier, there was four of us who sat the B subjects in the boardroom of AMP in Adelaide. I was the only one doing their final exam, and I was the only actuary in the state to qualify, which was a rather strange thing to do, going around offering champagne to everyone else in the office at 10 o'clock in the morning. But it was a very interesting experience, and I think one of the reasons I passed was because I had the opportunity, I was working with MLC, to go and spend some time out in the branch and actually get to see how all the distribution worked. It really did add value to my understanding on life insurance. Other way. Where is it? Did you put the slides in from data from last year?
No, I thought it was
waiting for that to be confirmed. Oh, they were. Didn't he copy you in on it? Okay.
No, sorry.
Do you want to see if you can find them?
Yeah, I'm trying to delete first.
Yeah, and then you can print off for me somewhere else. So last semester there was three of us that were here, David Tysos, myself, and Bruce, who does CAP, and we almost pretty much said the same thing. And David was the only one who did nice slides. He actually surveyed everyone in the office and asked them what they thought were good practical ideas for exams. So I was just going to run through some of those because they echo a lot of the things that I would be normally saying anyway. Most importantly, you've got to think about what the question is you are being asked and answer it. Don't read it and then put down what's in your head. Last semester, one of the questions in the 2A paper said, what are the obligations on a life insurance company for the role of the appointed actuary? And everyone started saying what the roles of the appointed actuary's obligations are and what the appointed actuary has to do, as opposed to that a life company must always have an appointed actuary, that the life insurance company has to inform APRA of a change, and a whole lot of things that's a life company's responsibility. So we're not trying to trick you. We want you to read a question and show that you understand what we're asking and not just rote learning. So take the time to read the question, look for the verbs, look for what's being asked. It's often good to underline various sections of it, highlight things, and then think about what's being asked. Preparation is important. The last semester of the exam paper also included this wonderful thing called a multiple decrement table. Those who don't know life insurance maybe haven't had the joys of building multiple decrement tables. The last time you probably saw them was in second year of university when you were doing part one. I can tell you only two candidates did the multiple decrement table correctly. So you should have those sorts of, in the old days when we didn't have computers, we used to have our book of formulas and tables. And they were always very useful to remember what the correct process was. So that you know that your LX plus one is from LX minus DXs, not LXs times one minus two Xs, and therefore you're stuffing up the formula. So be thinking about what the exam paper asks, and think about the way you answer the question. When it asks you to list the risks, you can say, you know, lapse risk, operational risk, asset risk. But you're not explaining that you know what they are. You've just thrown some words on a page. A good example, semester four last, a candidate wrote, when they're explaining the impact of something, they'd say high interest rates. But what they actually meant to say was higher interest rates. I know that because I actually had them on an exam performance interview. But when you're a marker and all you know is this candidate number, then you're looking at someone and saying, are they expressing something so I'm sure they know it, or are they fishing? And if you're sort of saying, well, this could be, it may be because of that, or it may be because of that, or it may be because of this, as opposed to the general causes of this thing are this, 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 and this, you're demonstrating you know something rather than you are trying to express an idea but not really sure of it and not putting it down succinctly. So a real challenge I would put you to is find the person in your office who is the most picky about report writing, who's the one who hates the grammar, who says your expression is bad, that you're not communicating well, and ask them to mark your trial exam papers. Because they are the ones who will then pick up the things that you will say, well, I know what I mean. But a marker won't necessarily know what you mean if they're not used to the way you express things. And when they're going through and looking for things, they'll be saying, well, is that well expressed? And be careful that you're not just expressing the same thing in multiple ways. If it asks you to list four things, but you can think of five, put the fifth one down. Because if two of them are pretty much the same thing expressed slightly differently, you'll still get full marks from four, whereas you only get 3 marks if you only written the four of them down. Similarly, when you're on the forum, where are those minimum number of posts, don't think, well, I've done my four unique posts and that's enough, because maybe someone else has done something first and the person who's awarding the marks is saying, well, that wasn't unique, it was following on from someone else's. So you've got to be sure, and the more time you spend on the forum talking about and digging through things, the better chance you've got to have a good understanding of the questions that are likely to come upon you. Because we do like to try and surprise you with, here's something you should know, but in a very different context. And how would that work? So we had last semester of a overseas life company looking at buying an Australian life company. Except the overseas life company was a retail specialist, and the company they were buying in Australia was a direct specialist. And so, well, what are the issues going on here? What's the differences in the nature of the business? What are the risks? Why would there be difference in best estimate assumptions? So if you know the nature of the business and you know these sorts of things, it's then applying it in different contexts. And that's where we're looking at trying to test your simple judgment and complex judgment rather than just your book work. When we're sort of saying, please express, yeah, well, we've got a rider benefit on a TPD product, death and TPD product, they want to marginally price it. What's the concept of marginal pricing? Can you express that? So it's important that you don't take forever writing your questions out, your answers out, but you should be clear in the ideas you're expressing. If I go, we've got David's first page. So yeah, these are the ideas that came from the people at David's work that he surveyed at the beginning of, well, a couple of weeks before the orientation for previous semester. So think about how you're going to create your worthwhile summary notes so you can access them and pull things out when you've got a question that you need to know something about. You don't want to be digging for everything forever. You've got to have a good indexing system, good cross-referencing system, that sort of thing. You're dealing with something electronic when you're answering your questions these days. Word does things like cut and paste. So you can write down your ideas and then build the sentences and the paragraphs and cut and paste and put things around. If you've got some ideas, splat them down. Put them at the bottom of the page. Even if you don't get the whole answer written out, if they're already on the page as your ideas, the marker might go, well, I can see where they're going, and you will get the benefit of the doubt because we can see the logic of what you're thinking. So don't think it's going to be perfectly fine at the first instance. Get it down there, build on it, have time to review it, and make sure you answer every question. I had a candidate come in for an exam performance interview who was most upset was about her fifth attempt. And was about to be, I'm really not sure I should be doing this. I said, well, you actually gave us the best answer of all candidates in one of the three questions. But you left out that in section two. And when she went through a paper, she went, yeah, so she missed out on 8 marks. And had she done as well as she had done the rest of the paper, she would have passed. But because that's the only section in that exam paper that looks at that part of the course, the marker doesn't know, did she just miss it? Did she run out of time or did she not know it? And we can't give the benefit of the doubt and say, if you haven't shown us and demonstrated the knowledge of a part of the course that's not examined anywhere else, but shown that you don't understand that part of the course, can we let you through as an actuary? How big is the omission? How big is the lack of understanding? Which is the other important thing is, if you're not sure, don't put it down there, because the markers are asked, please make the chief examiner aware of any dangerous comments. If you can, if you're saying something that's blatantly wrong or misinterpreting the situation, then it's like, do they really understand the question? Are they making a mistake? And we have to look at the whole paper and say, well, is this a candidate who's showing they understand what they're doing? And sometimes you can see it very easily. It's all very well laid out. You can understand the structure of the thinking. And at other times you think, did they read the question or they're just trying to tell me everything they know about unit pricing or everything they know about group risk? Many years ago, I wrote a question, and I actually was involved with marking them too, which said, you work for a life company as a product actuary. Your marketing actuary has just come to you and said, look, we've been selling disability income insurance for ages. Group salary contingent isn't that different. Let's sell that as well. And you had to draft your response. The number of candidates who said, but group mortality is heavier than individual mortality, was not small. But this was all about morbidity, and in fact, group morbidity is lighter than individual morbidity. So it was completely around the wrong way. So they saw a group question versus an individual question, and they just wanted to put everything they knew about it without looking, that it was actually asking about disability income type products rather than lump sum products. So you've got to stop and take the time. That's why you've got the 15 minutes reading time. That's why hopefully you've had enough experience with going through the exam papers that you're presented with a new idea and you logically think out, what's this question asking me and how do I demonstrate my answer? And that way it should become a natural to you. One of the prize winners from previous semester from investment finance, which isn't a very big course and they don't have many papers, so what'd he do? After being through all the Australian ones, he found all the UK ones, all the South African ones, and all the American ones. And deserved the prize, he knew what he was talking about, that's for sure. But having done that many papers and that much detail, he was sure of what he was doing, because it's a very high technical area. So getting the most marks, providing basic information, ensure that you cover the basic. Don't get fancy. So don't need to write prose. No one wants poetry, or at least not in an exam. Just get the points down there, but so it's understood what you mean. But a single word may not communicate that idea well. And I can tell you, having worked for the regulator for 9 years up until the end of last year, even something simple like operational risk means different things to different people. Operational risk for those people who are risk management specialists will say it's people, processes, and systems. And people who work in large organisations say, no, it's the risks of our operations, which means it's all of the risks. So operational risks, including people, processes, and systems, will make sure you're showing that you know what an operational risk is, as opposed to just saying operational risk, which may not sit well in the right context if the rest of what you're saying isn't very clear. As David says, we rarely have trick questions. The whole process of the exam development process, this semester's exam, the skeleton has started being built for 2A. I haven't seen it yet, so I can't tell you anything about it. I didn't want to look at it until after this evening. What happens is we have an exam writer who will discuss with various people, come up with some ideas, and then send a skeleton through. The chief examiner and two assistant examiners for that subject then work with the exam writer to tidy up the questions, look where we've got good coverage, they look at the course, you've got to map how the exam paper goes against the syllabus, so you've got a good spread, look at how the marks are allocated, and then start developing sample solutions. So we all work on that together and see what we think is reasonable. There may be someone involved from the faculty or someone that's actually involved in the industry to make sure we're actually speaking sense, to make sure that we've got what we believe is in an area of the industry that we're not specialist in, we're doing the exam question correctly. Once it's then at that stage, it goes to a scrutineer. That's not one of these prize winners from the previous semester. They don't qualify. It's got to be someone who passed, but not in the top ones. And they get to do it under exam conditions and should expect to do it within a reasonable time. If it takes too long, then the exam paper's too long. And that's the feedback we get. So we get someone to sit the paper for real and give us feedback. Did they understand it? Was it clear? Was it easy? Was there anything not well expressed? So we take that feedback from someone who's only just recently done the exam and passed it. And then as a last step, it will then go to someone who hasn't been involved in the process for an independent review, because when you've been working over and over and over on a paper, sometimes you read what you think is there, not what's actually written, and they'll pick up typos or an occasional missing word. And at the exam, post-exam discussions a couple of weeks ago, in fact, someone pointed out the typo we missed. And I promised her a box of chocolates when she's next back. But it's a very, very thorough process. Then when it comes to the marking, for each question, 2 markers are allocated. Six papers are chosen, and they're asked to mark the question on those, and then they get together with one of the examination team, one of the assistant examiners or the chief examiner, and compare their results and discuss how they marked it. So if there are differences between how the 2 markers marked it, they'll discuss why. They'll look at the marking guide that they were given versus the way they marked and say, was there anything the marking guide didn't cover very well? Was it not looking at things? So it was very clear. So we've got a good standard. Once that's all resolved, the 2 markers go off and mark all the papers separately. Then their data is put together and they're compared. So it's a huge, big spreadsheet. Anyone who has insomnia, I can give you the spreadsheet to play with. They go for pages and pages and pages. But it basically takes all the marker 1 results and marker 2 results and compares them and looks for discrepancies. So if marker 1 and marker 2 are greater than 10% of the marks for that question apart, they have to resolve their difference. They have to pull that paper back out, remark it together, and discuss why you gave a mark there and I didn't. So there's that sort of thing done. Once they've marked all the papers, they'll then say, well, for this question, I think that's a reasonable pass mark given the candidates. And I'll look at the candidates who got the pass mark or just above and just below and say, yes, I think that's a good line. So they'll recommend for the question they've marked what they think is the pass mark and what's an A and what's a D. The C is set at 90% of a B. So you are within 10%. So the 3 questions are then resolved that way, and they then come to me as chief examiner. I combine them into a summary sheet. So it takes the details off each of those, looks at the recommendations from the markers, and myself and the 2 assistant examiners say, well, do we think that's a reasonable recommendation for the pass mark and what the spread of marks is for each of the 3 questions? Plus we get from the participation forum the results there. And as Oscar and Eleanor said earlier, it surprises me that not more people are getting full marks in the forum. It's your best way to get out there and learn and interact, particularly if you're not working a particular part of the topics in the subject. Someone else out there is. So if you're working in individual business and you want to understand group business, try and find someone else on the forum who wants to talk to you about the way they do group business. Don't disclose any commercial secrets. I can tell you I'm not allowed to tell you an awful lot of things I learned at APRA. I'll end up in jail. But there's an awful lot out there in knowledge that people do share, and there are a lot of actuarial papers that are presented and a lot of very good senior actuaries that are very happy to mentor students, and you can take that knowledge and share it with the other people on the forum as a way of sharing the knowledge. So we've got the 3 questions plus the participation forum. That's all then aggregated together. The default pass mark that is recommended by the 3 questions, so the 6 markers, it'll sit out and you press a little button and it sorts them in ranking order and has the borderline candidates plus or minus three marks of the recommended pass mark. So we've got to look at all of those borderline candidates, the 2 lowest passes and the 2 highest fails, and say, do they all seem that's an appropriate fail, that's an appropriate pass, and let's have a look at these guys and see how they demonstrate their understanding. So my assistant examiners and I look at each of those papers and discuss them. And we have to write up in the chief examiner's report why we decided to pass or fail that candidate. If we are saying we think we should have awarded them more marks or deducted marks, that's then done. So we can vary the markers' marks and we can vary the markers' recommended pass rate. And then that then spits out into nice summary reports, which are all very detailed. And then that goes up to the board of examiners for review. And then they can come back to me and challenge me on any candidate and say, that candidate number there versus that candidate number there, they've got similar marks. Why did you pass that one and why didn't you pass that one? And so it gets to that sort of level of detail. And all the time they're sort of saying, well, did they really not give you sufficient? Why didn't they earn that ability to get over the mark. And I don't know at this stage if it's their first attempt, their fifth attempt, if they're in Sydney or in Melbourne. All I know is a number. It's not until actually I've had my report signed off and the results sent out that I actually know who the names of the people are with those numbers. So it's a challenge, but you need to just take it easy. Don't get freaked out by the exam papers and be methodical with them. So I think some people do get a bit worried about the time and you need to get enough practice so that you get used to them. Wrong way. Studying in groups, motivation. Study past exam papers a few times so you can go back to them as you've gone through things. Bruce Thompson used to always say for every one of the module 2 and 3 courses, you need to do them twice. You can do them twice in one semester if you like, but until you've gone through the whole course, it really doesn't make sense to you. So once you've gone through the whole course and you start going through it again, then you've got a more comprehensive understanding of what you're going through. Comment on your answers for reasonableness. Look if they seem sensible. Usually there is a lot more marks available to get than the marks required for a question. So if there's the 30-mark question, there may be 40 marks possible in correct answers. You're only expected to get about 20 of those. So it's not hard if you just think logically and break the question down on what it's asking. If it's asking for the advantages and disadvantages, that's obvious. You need the advantages and disadvantages. Yeah. List 4 criteria, at least 4. If you can think of more, put it down there. Time management. Give yourself time to check at the end, if you possibly can. Again, it comes with practice of working your way through. Sorry, going the other way. Review past papers of the model solutions before the exam to learn and understand what markers are looking for. So we do change exam writers from time to time. You do change markers from time to time. But generally, you will see when you look at the sample solutions, how they're laid out, how they're answering the question, to think about how you go about things like that. David says a banana and a Red Bull. I'd say probably it's something a little bit more wholesome. Anyone who has never had a bowl of matcha, I can thoroughly recommend it. It'll keep you going for hours. Once you understand technical context, ask yourself what the question could be asked. Yeah? A single list can answer many questions, so be careful about what you're doing. Mind mapping, if that does for you, is a good thing. As I said, someone else to mark your exams is good, and try and get the most nitpicky ones so that they're really good at picking your language. Look for the keywords and flags. I think during the reading time you can highlight things on your exam paper, you just can't start writing on the computer, so have that highlighter pen with you, or maybe a pencil. So the past exam questions show you how they're applying theory, so there's value in them. I know Bruce Thompson in 2A has great delight in having nothing to do with the exam paper, and in the third tutorial he tries to predict what questions will be in there based on what's topical in the industry. And he gets about a 70 to 80% success rate. When you sort of say, I bet you there's going to be something on life insurance framework, which there was, and that sort of stuff, mergers and acquisitions. So if you keep an eye on what's going on in the media and what's happening in the industry, keep an eye on the financial press and what's being discussed about, actuarial presentations going on, the insight sessions, then that can give you a feel for what's happening in the industry and is relevant today. There is heaps of stuff going through the Royal Commission at the moment. It's going to be very interesting to see where that ends up. Textbooks, which always trying to tidy them up and improve on them, and we're actually doing a syllabus review at the moment. But they're a good starting point, and again, there are senior actuaries or qualified actuaries where you're working, unless you are self-employed, and they are usually very happy to help explain ideas and concepts if you're not clear on them, or show you how things apply in certain circumstances. There's nothing quite like real-life situations to give you a real understanding of things. The marks, if it's a 5-mark question, expect there'll be things like 5 points, or if it's a 6-mark question, it says the advantages and disadvantages, it's 3 of each, that sort of thing. The work-life balance has already been spoken about. David's trick for his studies was he used to do it in the morning. He used to get up very early, get into the office like 5 a.m., and actually study until 10 a.m. and start work at 10. That was the way he managed his study time. So he was fresh, he was studying, he was in the office, so the boss knew he was studying, and the boss knew it was study, so he left him in his in a closed room, and then he was there to get his work done. So an awful lot easier to study and remember and learn things that way than after a full day's work to then try and open the books. So whatever works for you is the pattern that you need to establish. But you need that diligence, because once you fall behind, it's very hard to catch up. And you really need to be ahead of where the course should be at, so you're on top of things and know what's going on and have time to stop and question if there's something new that's come up you don't understand well. Read the question is something. If you go and look at the past Board of Examiners reports, so the report I have to send up to Council for approval, a lot of the individual information is cut out of it, but all the general summary topics are then made publicly available. So the discussion about how candidates answered the paper and what they commonly did wrong and how they missed things. And in most subjects, in most semesters, you will see at least one mention of candidates did not read the question. So when you have done an exam paper, don't just look at the sample solutions. Look at the Board of Examiners report for that semester as well. And what did the Chief Examiner say how that paper was answered by candidates who sat for real at the time? And see if you made the same mistakes the candidates did, or if you didn't fall into some of the traps that those candidates seem to have done wrong. And that will give you an idea if you're really on top of what you're doing or not, or if there's things you're missing and wouldn't have picked that up. And thought, well, that's like, isn't it? Oh, what did I do wrong? Go back to the guy at work and say, what did I do wrong? And they'll explain to you if they can. Spread your study over term, start early, don't get stuck on questions. So if you're not sure about something, let your brain stew on it and go on to the next question and come back to it. Don't get stuck on something and just wasting time. Very important for time management. I've talked about highlighting. So there's a whole lot here. Hopefully these will end up on the LMS. So they're all there for you to be able to access later and read in more detail. But we're not here to prevent you being actuaries. Believe me, it would be so much nicer to get that pass rate up higher. And it's a real struggle when you're writing a paper to try and get people to apply their judgment and analysis, and you want to try and be in as plain English and straightforward as possible without leading you by the hand. It's a real challenge. So don't look for something that's not there. More think about what's the actuarial principles I should be applying to this question and what is it they're actually asking, because that's the way you'll pass the exam. Now, do I pass straight on to...
Yeah, we're going to pass straight on to Tim.
And do I need to change to one of the other...
Just swap.
Yep. That one?
Tim. Thanks, Anthony. My name is Tim Lamb. I work at KPMG, and I'm very lucky to be prize winner of 2A. I can definitely say that because I actually work with David. So David actually made a presentation to us, did a training course with us, all with that slide deck, and we were one of those people who actually contributed to that. And certainly I used it as part of my study techniques this semester, and it was very useful. And on that, what I want to talk about today is not so much about my own study techniques, because like I said, just read that, that's actually very useful. But more importantly is I actually failed three times before I passed this semester. So I want to take you through what I've learned through the past three times and what I've learned from it and what I've changed each time in order to very luckily pass this semester. So the first time I did my Part 3s was in semester 1, 2016, taking the 2A exam. And at that time, I decided to double up with my Part 2s. So the first question I asked myself afterwards is, was it actually worth doubling up two subjects? In hindsight, probably not. What the reason for that is, as we will find out later, that studying and working is actually very difficult. I had to work long hours, given that I started in July and was year-end for us. I had to study a Part 3 course, which in hindsight, and I know now, is about, two or three uni courses combined, and I had to do a Control Cycle 2 uni course. So essentially, I was doing a full uni load and working five and a half days a week because it's year-end. So then I basically didn't have a lot and I didn't pass. So when I went to the exam and I got my exam results back, because if you fail, you actually get a letter telling you how you went in each grade. I did great in one question and I failed one miserably, purely because I didn't know anything about it. So what I got from that attempt is that I needed to study more. So there I was in my second attempt at Part 3 in Semester 1 2017. I was actually took 6A out of my interest. But I learned for the first time that I really needed to study. So I studied regularly, and I studied a lot harder. And I actually utilized my study leave as study leave rather than as taking a break from work and recovering. And that, to be honest, is actually very important. And I knew the content well. I went through all the notes. I went through the text. Oh, well, I didn't have a textbook, but I went through all the notes, went through all the course notes, reading materials, and I read a lot about not only in what's happening in the retirement income market in Australia, but also overseas as well. And that was great. So I went next time going, yep, I study a lot this time. This should be a chance. But I failed again. So when I went out and I got a letter and I looked at it, I knew exactly why. So I did. I passed question one. I passed question three, but I didn't pass question two. The reason for that is question two, and I still remember this very clearly, was on, if you did Control Cycle, there's an article in Control Cycle textbook on the DB liability crisis in US, but the question was on UK. And given that it's 6A, it's pretty easy to guess the questions because everybody will post about everything that's relevant in the industry at that time. And someone in the forum post actually posted an article about that particular crisis, referring to regulations. So I went to the exam and I wrote everything but regulations. Unfortunately, that's not what you need to be an actuary. I learned very quickly after that exam that as an actuary, you really need to consider not just regulations, risk management, and basically everything that's relevant. And I learned that from looking at the exam or the model solutions later on. I also learned it from talking to my mentors at work as well. So from that time, I learned that yes, it's important to understand the course materials, but it's also important to be able to consider everything that is relevant, not just and not anchor on a particular article that you've read. And also, more importantly, forum posts is important. If you read all of them, there's a very high chance that someone will post something that is relevant, because like Anthony said, the markers will also write on things that are relevant, because it's not easy to come up with questions. So generally, think about what's happening in the industry and what we talk about at work. So failed twice, third attempt now, and we went to semester 2, 2017, so just the last semester. And it was my third attempt at Part 3s, my second attempt at 2A. So I learned to consider everything now, and I studied quite hard, but as you can see with me taking on 6A, I have an interest, particular interest in a particular area, and for some of you, you might work in a particular area, like Anthony said, you might work in individual risk, or you might work in group risk, etc. So I went into the exam and I wasn't sure if this was lucky or not, but there was a retirement income question and annuities for question one. And I still remember that very clearly. Went into it into reading time and I was like, yep, I got this. Easy. I'm going to write everything that I know in there. And that I did. And I'm pretty sure I wrote everything in there that wasn't needed because it was too niche. It was probably related to 6A more than to 2A, but it wasn't what the markets wanted. And what I learned out of that exam is that it's not about what you, when I'm studying for the exam, it's not about what I'm interested in or what I want to say, but it's, you need to try to understand what the examiners want. What would an actuary think about in an exam? Well, not in an exam, in practice as well. When they're talking to, say, the board or talking to, in my case, talking to clients who might or may not be actuaries. And so with that, I went in my fourth attempt and I made a few changes. For my third attempt at 2A and my fourth attempt at Part 3s, I actually made an active attempt to talk to actuaries within my team from different countries. I'm very lucky to work in a consulting firm, so we've got actuaries from South Africa, UK, and obviously in Australia as well, and make an active I guess, initiation to talk to them, because they are all, they generally come from different countries, they know different products. But like, again, like Anthony said, you can get a lot out of them because they have specialized knowledge, and more importantly, they understand what an actuary think, how an actuary would think. So they trained me up to understand how an actuary would think, and it helped me in writing my answers in my model exams and also my actual exam. Not only that, I was very lucky that in my team there are a few prize winners, so then I talked to them about study techniques as well, but I wouldn't go too much into that because that's actually what they wrote in that slide deck that Anthony brought up, and it will be available on LMS, so I would definitely, as I said, recommend you to look at it. But one point I want to make that I did very differently this semester, but that's only because I had, I had a lot more time, was that I went back to, I almost went back to what I did in high school. So in your course notes, it actually has dot points. So I actually wrote dot point notes like we did in high school. If anyone's to remember how we studied in high school with all those dot points in chemistry, etc. I did that for part three. And it was very important because I'm not rote learning, but those dot points actually make you think about the industry and how it's applied in the industry, because those dot points actually is very broad. It makes you I think one of them talks about selective lactation, but it doesn't tell you what selective lactation is. It doesn't tell you how you apply it in practice, but it makes you research and think about how it can be applied in different products. And very luckily this time I passed, and that's my learnings throughout my past four attempts. And I think an important point I want to say to conclude is that we saw on the screen we're more likely to fail than pass. So don't treat failure as, a failure, but treat it as an opportunity to learn. There must have, one of our partners who was surprised when she was studying said to me that the fact that I failed multiple times means that I'm missing something. I'm missing something important. So every time that I failed, I tried to find what was missing, and I think very luckily on my fourth attempt, I finally found everything that was missing, and I passed. Thank you. I'll pass to Kale now.
Great, thanks, Tim. I don't know how I can. So it's on there? Great. Oh. Hi, I'm Kale, like the spinach. I whipped up some of these slides just before because I'm such a great employee. I was focusing on my work. That's the one.
Worth making it.
Oh, no, the one.
They talk about that average 3 years.
Oh, sorry.
Qualifying. You've got to remember that there are some people like Ian Pollard who qualified at the age of 17. Yep. He was the son of John Pollard, who was professor head of school for Friday, whose father, Al Pollard, was professor. So they bring the average down. The rest of us have to sit them a few times in to get the average of that 3 years.
Hey, so I just happened to get the top mark in 2B. I guess in Australia, but I think two people said it in Singapore, so I'm describing it as the best in the world. I thought I'd start by talking about morale. This is a picture of me before I started the part ones in 2011, and this is me right before my first attempt at 2A when I actually failed. Exam failure can be very demoralizing. It kind of threw me upside down. My mum always said I was special, and I felt like she'd lied to me, but I want you to remember that you are still very special, and it's just the fact that you're in a very big pond now. You're still a big fish, but you're in a very big pond. These exams are about effort and luck. Like, sometimes you might get a really hard exam and there's nothing you can do about it, or sometimes there might be an exam that's not phrased super clearly, but if they're erring on the side of caution, they have to fail you if you can't show that you are, if you can't show your professional actuarial side. So there is an element of luck in there, but really the more effort you put in, the less luck you need to put in. Based on my original attempt at 2A, I'd say that don't cram everything before the exam. Try and space it out so you keep a bit of livelihood, a bit of a social life, because it can be quite demoralising, constantly studying and losing your social life. There's really no sugarcoating the time commitment. My girlfriend's forgotten what I look like, my pot plants are all dead, and for this year for my birthday, I'm going to finally go to the dentist. But struggling and stressing is how we learn. If everything's really easy and you just read the solutions and see what the solutions for an exam are, you won't learn anything. Struggling and going, argh, that's when you start to learn. Another tip for keeping your morale high is look at the pass rates for past exams and do a mix of easy and hard exams. Don't just do all hard exams and then cry into your pillow at night. Do like one easy, one hard, and you'll get a better idea. And also, after you do a paper and you correct it, make sure you look at the Board of Examiners reports, because I did one paper, I got 24% of it correct, and I was feeling really awful, but then I read that the pass mark was 22%, so I felt a lot better. Setting a realistic study schedule and pacing yourself. So the way I did it on this last two attempts, so I actually did 2A in 2016, like Tim did, and I failed miserably. I got an F for one of the subjects, one of the questions, sorry. And then in the last two semesters, I've passed 2A and 2B. But I set up this new schedule of doing things. So I kind of set, to balance with work, I called a weeknight 0.5 of a day, and I called a weekend, a study day, or a public holiday a 1. And then I basically looked, when is the exam? And I counted back realistically, how many days do I actually have between now and when the exam is? And I added them all up, and then based on that, I had about 23 notes days. That's 23 days I set aside to actually go through the textbook, where I said there's 200 pages, so I need to do at least 8.7 pages a day. And then I had 34 exam days. My first attempt at 2A, it was more like 40 notes days and 10 for exams. So notice that you really need to do it 50% or more on exams, at least 8 weeks before the exam. The thing I was going to say with the exam practice, because I spoke to some of the other students at work who didn't actually pass, is that I would set aside a whole weekend to do one paper. So I know it's a 3-hour paper, but the way I would sort of, maybe it's on my next slide actually. My exam schedule on a weekend, this is how depressing it was. Sort of wake up at 10 a.m. This is on the right hand side. 10 to 1, I'm doing life admin. I'm ironing, I'm cooking, I'm cleaning, I'm exercising, obviously not getting haircuts or shaving. 1 to 2, I'm doing a timed exam question. So each exam question takes about an hour. Do it to time, because basically when you're inside the exam and the timer starts, you can be extremely confident, you can look really good at work, and the moment that typing starts really loudly, your brain will just leave your head, and instead of answering questions, you'll just be thinking, ba-da, da-da-da-da-da. So you need to try the exams to time, because you think in a different way when you're under stressed situations. I would do it to an hour. If I didn't finish in an hour, then I'd turn off the timer and keep going, and try and finish that question rather than just correct it straight away, and then I'd have a break. And so an exam would take a whole day, basically. Another tip I'd have is asking for help. Actuaries at work are an invaluable resource. But if you book a meeting with an expert at work, send your questions in advance. This will make them like you more. More than enough for the session, like it's terrible booking them for an hour and then you finish at the 40-minute mark, and order your questions by importance. These are probably general things. And rotate between the actuaries so you're not overusing one resource and making them hate you. In fact, one of the people I was asking lots of questions to has just left the company I work at, and I hope I'm not the reason. And also post questions to the discussion board. Even if they're never answered and you're just writing words into the ether, it's good practice because you're practicing drafting, putting your thoughts into words. And the one other thing I was going to say on the exam schedule is try and keep a bit of a diary as you go. If you didn't get as much done as you wanted to, write it down and you'll feel less guilty, and also you'll be able to adapt your schedule later because you might have been too optimistic. Where do you get your questions? So obviously exam practice. So a big part of correcting exams and sitting them is that you would write questions as you go. But also in the textbook. A lot of the textbook won't actually make sense the first time you read it, or you won't see the point of some of the sections. So if you come across a concept you don't understand, just highlight in red. Most of my yearly budget has gone towards red highlighters in the last 12 months. But make a guess in the margin and what you think it might mean. Summarise those questions for each chapter on the first page. And sometimes, especially for some of the courses, you'll actually find a better answer to your question in a later chapter. So don't fret, don't stress, write down your question, keep going. Try and keep to your schedule, try and get through the textbook as quickly as you can so you can get onto exam practice. Making great exam notes. So before, as Anthony was saying, it's an open book exam, but really you don't want to, I found, you might be different, but I found from my two attempts, evidenced by one was a complete fail and one was a pass, say for when I did 2A. When I first did 2A, my notes were really summarising the textbook. So say something like, what is a lapse? Oh, it's when someone stops paying premiums. Or how does a lapse affect profit? Profit decreases unless it's a level premium policy at long durations. Sort of general things like that. But when you're in the exam, you don't have time to read the textbook. You don't have time to read your detailed notes. You need some lists that will be able, you'll just be able to whip out in a second and then try and finish those list questions and try and get as many marks on the board in a hurry so that you can have more brain power and time for the harder questions. So see that sort of shift? My first set of notes were sort of what is a lapse, whereas my second set of notes were really to the meat of the question, reasons for improving lapse experience. Because you'll get questions like, here's some data, did lapses get better or worse? And suggest a reason why. And so you can analyse, that's something you can't really, you can practice for but can't prepare a list for, but those ideas, general thinking out loud, reasons why lapses might get worse, that's the sort of stuff you can brainstorm in advance. I was also going to say, when you're doing your questions, you can get a friend to mark your papers, preferably a friend who hates you, because you want to be harsh on yourself and not give yourself false hope. Or mark your own exams, but make sure you're full of self-loathing before you do it. And when I say correcting your exam notes, I mean making sure you know exactly how all the spreadsheets work. So not just you look at the model solution and say, well, I got none of that correct. Go through their solution and figure out what's the point of every cell. If something's highlighted yellow, why was it yellow? That level of detail. And also trying to think about what's an awesome exam question that hasn't been asked. So when I was preparing for 2B, I saw that a year ago there was a question on the insurance risk charge, calculating it from scratch. And I realised that they've never asked a question about the asset risk charge. So the day before the exam, I stumbled across and had a go at the worked example of an asset risk charge in the textbook. And then in the exam, that was 33% of the paper. So if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be standing here. I'd probably be eating chocolate chip ice cream and watching Gilmore Girls reruns. But I'm glad I did. So try and think of exam questions that haven't been asked yet. And the other thing I would suggest is that when you're in the exam, read the question before you read the paragraph. This is an excerpt from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which I just grabbed on my way here. It might be a large paragraph and you might spend 10 minutes reading it or 20 minutes reading it if you're a slow reader like me. But then you get to the question, it may not have anything to do with the paragraph you just read. Or it may not directly reference it. So what I would do is I would skip the paragraph and go straight to the question. What do I actually need to get out of the paragraph before I read it? So I've got more purposed reading. So this one here is list three types of desserts, 3 marks. I look at that, I go, they need 3 points. So that one I would do really quickly and hopefully I've pre-brainstormed 3 different types of desserts or I'd just remember them. Question two would be something more expansive, like design a gluten-free recipe for chocolate using information in table 2, 10 marks. So I look at that and I think I can do it, but it's going to take a lot of time. So I wouldn't rush it. I wouldn't skip it. I would set my timer for, if it's 3 minutes per mark, I'd set my timer for 30 minutes and spend exactly 30 minutes. And after 30 minutes, I get off the question. Whereas question three might be insane. Describe the complete history of chocolate from the original cacao plant described by the Olmecs in 1000 BC. 4 marks. In that sense, I would skip that entirely and then go to the next question and come back to it at the end of the paper. And also, when you're writing your answers to questions, put your best three arguments first, I would say, rather than reel off all your dot points. Put your best three first, then check the clock, then explain them, then put your next best three down. Rather than writing everything down and without explaining anything, and rather than explaining one point really well. Great. So if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them after this. I'll hand over to Luke. Thanks so much.
Good evening, everyone. My name's Matt. I jumped the queue in front of Luke. I work in the life team at Suncorp, and last semester I sat 6A for the fourth time, passed, and CAP for the first time and passed. So I wanted to run through a few tips, both general tips and study tips, along with my exam tips as well. So first things with study plans, completely agree with Cale. I did something similar that he showed you on the projector, but I did in a week's basis rather than detailed to the day basis. On that, I'd say the most important thing is to build in breaks throughout the semester. Work gets busy, you get sick, you feel lazy, you don't want to do it, you're hungover, whatever. That comes into the semester, and if you have that wriggle room that can allow for that without you starting to freak out because you're behind. The next thing would be, in my opinion, from my past exam attempts, I think there's a huge disconnect between the notes, the textbook, and what is examined. So in saying that, I think that just highlights the idea that you want to spend, you want to go through the notes and the textbook as quickly as possible the first time, and then get straight onto past exams. And then from the past exams, you'll get a feel for what examiners are looking for. And then you can always go back to the notes and you have that fresh context around what the exam questions will actually be asking you. And then you can skim the notes again. And it's as Anthony said, you may have to do the course a few times. That could be over multiple semesters like me in 6A, or a few times in the one semester. Again, following on from that, I would say keeping up to date with topical issues is a key study tip. This could be YouTube videos, Four Corners episodes, newspapers, forums, etc. This might not feel like study, but in my opinion, it was a lot more useful than some of the core prescribed readings as part of the course. That's not saying don't do the core readings, but just, you know, get a feel for what is actually examined rather than doing all of the notes just to tick it off and say, yes, you've done. You might feel better, but it may not help you with your study. Particularly for 6A and 6B with the smaller cohort of students, Vivian, the tutor, is very helpful with, if you submit him a past exam, he's more than happy to mark it, give you feedback, which I found invaluable. That means you not only practice the past exams under time conditions, you also get feedback from one of the people heavily involved in marking the actual exam paper. Again, with the forums, personally, I'd rather get roasted before the exam and pass than have people think I know what I'm talking about and then fail. Others might disagree, but we're all here to pass. Now, onto exam tips. Cale touched on it as well. Time management. You're always going to freak out in the last, say, half an hour of the exam. I'd say it's preferable that you spread that half an hour of freak out evenly over all of the questions, rather than nail two questions, completely bomb the last question, and then you're most likely going to fail the paper just because you blew it in one question. Again, particularly with 6A and 6B, I'm sure it's similar with the other subjects as well. Practice Excel questions. yes, you can write out your answers or type your answers, but I found there was always at least one question where it was heavily Excel calculation based. And if it's something different to what you usually do at work on Excel, that kind of throws you off a bit. So make sure you practice a lot of questions in Excel. Always, when you're reviewing your exam or what you've written, always ask the question, so what? That's the judgment element that they're trying to examine. You can write a statement, and then if you think, but what does this mean? That will get you thinking as to, here's the fact that you stated, but what does that mean in the particular context of the question and in a commercial environment, which is a key point that the examiners are trying to draw out in your answer. And then the last point that I have, which is probably more relevant to people who have failed multiple times, is that this is just an exam. I guess hopefully you have a much more exciting life outside of work and study. Just because you fail doesn't mean you're not intelligent, you're an idiot. Plenty of intelligent people fail these exams. And I guess once I stopped putting my life on hold for these exams, I started taking holidays. I bought a house at the start of the year, in the middle of the semester. Then following that approach, I've actually passed three exams in two semesters, and I've topped two. So for me, more snowboarding trips and exotic holidays seem to have done the trick. I'm happy to stick around at the end if anyone has any questions. More than happy to have a chat. Thank you.
Cool. Hi, everyone. My name's Luke, and I was lucky enough to get the prize for Finance B in this semester. It is probably a bit difficult to go after all that and all that because it's a lot of the good content. Certainly, I can see a lot of what I did in the presentation, in the notes, and all that sort of stuff. So definitely take notice of that. I also went to the dentist after I passed, so I don't know if that's if that's something we all do, but life certainly comes back. So I thought probably a good story to tell, especially if you're starting part three for the first time, would be my reaction to the exam materials when I first got home after lugging it all home. So I did ERM as the first course I did, and they get to send you a big box from the UK Institute, and it's got your two textbooks and all your notes, and you got a folder to put it together. And I walked home, I was feeling happy about it, chuffed. The thing got quite heavy by the end of it, but I got home and I put out all the modules. I thought I'll just look module one, module two, putting it into the binder. And very quickly I had a whole floor full of about, like, I think it's about 36 modules and two textbooks and a bunch of readings on top of that. And I just remember being gutted. I was like, geez, what have I actually got myself into? This thing looks completely unconquerable. And I put it all into the binder and I went to the gym. I did not want to start. So I did that, came back home and actually started on module one. I certainly just start chipping away at it. And thankfully from them, I've been lucky to go, I've done three now and go straight through. I guess part three can be very intimidating. Certainly for me, it's the first time you are doing a course where you sort of don't have that curator, that teacher, that lecturer that's every week is going to do something with you and you're going to keep up with the cohort. Really, it's on you to set your goals. And certainly, I was probably a little bit less organized, but the stuff that Kale mentioned in, like, the Excel spreadsheets, what day you're going to do work on and stuff like that. So I guess firstly, a bit relevant for me, I actually work in non-traditional fields. So I started a company called Quantium, which is technically a company rooted in actuarial studies. But I actually did a lot of e-commerce marketing analytics. And since then, I've actually moved on to a software company. And so actually the first question Tim asked me was, like, why do you do it? So that was a good question. But really, I find when you're looking at this course, what you get out from it, it really is a practical course. Like, you're going to really test and build your judgment. I mean, how I see it is it really builds my, I don't know if it's a word, but my stochastic acumen. It's like, how do you work with the risk, with the data, and really, like, how do you understand what stakeholders need, and how do you communicate that back to them, communicate those difficult things. So I guess quick things on what I noted. I don't actually know, but I assume I got 10 out of 10 participation every time for the discussion forum. Seriously, it's not that hard. Just agree to do it. Just in the same sort of plan. Like this week, we'll do one post, that week. I didn't do a Red Bull, but I think that would be very recommended. And again, also, I actually wrote notes. When I read through the book, I actually never really go back and look at them. But as I read a module, I write down, like, what's a key point here, key point here, key point here. It's just by getting that sort of connection in your hand, having to write it down, I feel I'm a lot more likely to remember it. So again, probably the best thing I heard, and it has been echoed around study, is that get through the notes as quickly as possible. I generally aim that the semester is about a bit over 3 months, I think, and generally try and get through them in two. So get through as quickly as possible. If there's something that you're a little bit stuck on, just get the core, move on, and get to those practice exams. Really, by covering everything, like, don't look at the practice exam straight away. You will be clueless, you'll be intimidated, stuff like that. But get through the course, get into the practice exams, and then go back to the course if you need to. Work out where the holes were and really what you need to sort of revise on. The other thing I'd say is really make the most of your study leave in how you schedule that and organise that up front. If you're someone who needs a day off every week, or if you're someone who can cram at the end, really be purposeful and try to get the most out of it. I know it's offered by a lot of employers, so certainly try and get that. And on that, I think be very purposeful in how you spend your nights. I actually started at night, but one of the worst things you can do to yourself is try to study one night, fail at it, and then just spend the rest of the night on telly. Like, it's not to say don't have your nights off, but when you have the nights off, make the most of it. Like, if you're going to watch telly all night, just watch telly. Do not even think about your course. But if you're going to do your course, just sit there and actually just get it done. The worst thing you can do is just have these half nights where you're sort of caught between the two. You're either trying to relax, just worrying about your course, or trying to do your course and you're not fully into it. Yeah, I guess otherwise, again, on exam technique, it is important. Like, I always see it's about 3 hours, so 1 hour per question. And really is if you're doing sort of sub-exams on each question, like, how are you going to finalise that course? Sorry, that question. Obviously, you can sort of distribute if there's one question that you feel are going to take longer than, but really, I think it's not really the case. You've got 1 hour to get the best crack out on each question. I think on study notes as well, look, to be honest, I don't often actually look at the notes too much in the exams, but it's always good to have that reference. And if there's a question that you're going to get stuck on, like, you're going to really regret if you didn't write that note or you didn't have that reference to you, to go back and actually think, just look at it and really try and infer what you need to put back on the exam. I think computer comfort as well. I mean, this is for me, like, I use a Mac primarily, and if you try and lock a cell in Mac, it's Command-T, Excel, it's F4. So I actually practice a lot with Excel on the Word, actually in the 2003 edition as well, just so you can get all those commands. And as you say, if you're trying to do an Excel spreadsheet as quickly as possible, again, those little micro sort of saving of 5 minutes and stuff just means you have more time to focus elsewhere. And then, yeah, I guess my last point I sort of had was that, I guess I've never worked in industry and stuff, but I've seemed to do okay. And I think to some degree it's because really in these exams, as I've said, that they're trying to instill what you can interpret from the course and apply. Like, it's less about the formulas. Honestly, it's maybe one question in an exam might be a bit more technical, but it's really going to be this stakeholder wants to achieve this. Explain options to them, like, explain the risks of these options and do that sort of thing. And really, if you approach it in the world that, like, this is a, like, everything we probably do is some complex underlying system with some approximate mathematical model that we need to use, understand limitations of, and communicate. As soon as you work out there, that's really all it is. And you just need to work out how you're going to communicate that to people and use that ongoing. So, yeah, I guess I'll be around as well. But, yeah, thanks for your time.
So thank you to all our guests. We're going to open it up to questions from the floor. I think, you know, obviously they're all in different subjects, and as you can hear, it's a very unique journey for everybody. So if you guys have any questions for us, we will open it up, and like the panel said, they will be available, as well as online if there are any questions. You can just put that in the chat box. We're going to do a quick couple of questions right now, and then we're going to move into a different section. We're going to introduce to you our actual educator team, and they're going to talk a little bit about the program in the future and what it's going to look like. Do we have any questions?
I just keep up with the easy question now. I've got a bit confused how you're going to start and the format of the exam. So I'm doing an EIM subject this semester, so that's going to be all the work and the computerized exam.
So the SD9 exam, which is the UK-based exam, that's a slightly different format. So like I said, that was modules 2 and 3, which is from course 2A and going down. But yeah. I would need to check that for you. I can definitely let you know. It is, I think. Yeah. Do you have any questions for anyone on the panel or for Anthony? Or are we happy to move on? Do you want to check if there's any questions online? If not, we can move on to the next session. All right. Okay, we don't have any questions at the moment. I will first introduce Sarah Tedesco, who is the Head of Strategic Projects. I think that's where it starts.
Right, lovely to see you all this evening. We're not going to take too much of your time because we know it's getting late, but we just wanted to give you a little bit of an inside scoop. So you may be aware that we're introducing a new education program at the Actuaries Institute. There's been a little bit about it in Actuaries Digital. And we now have a bit more information about that program that we wanted to share with you this evening. You are getting this information before the rest of the membership, before the people who are working on the education program currently, before sort of pretty much anyone else. So it is very early information. This information we're giving to you because for some of you, only maybe a few of you, it might impact what you want to study this semester. So you may want to change your enrollment, you may not, but it's only likely to be a few of you that it may impact, if anyone at all. So that's why we're giving you this information now, because we know that the closing date for the enrolments is the 23rd of July and we want to give you some time to consider this information. And that's why we're sending it to you earlier than the other membership. And this will come out to you in written format early next week, so you'll be able to look through that information then. So in terms of the inside scoop, yes, we are introducing a new education program and it's going to be phased in over a number of years. So starting in 2019, we'll start to introduce some of the new components and it will all be in by 2023. For most of you in this room, there's no impact. Some of you, it might provide you with some additional options that you might want to consider in terms of other subject choices. And if you've had no past attempts at doing life insurance, so 2A or 2B, or 6A, 6B, so the Global Retirement Income Systems course, then you might want to consider pros and cons if you want to start the new subjects in these areas that start in 2019. Just to be clear, there's no change to the qualification standard. So it's not like the existing Part 3 will have harder exams than the new subjects that are coming in. It's the same qualification standard. Okay, so what have we got in terms of a new program? We used to have something called Part 1. The new program is the foundation program and it includes 7 subjects. It can be, you can learn it from an accredited university or you can study it directly with the institute. We then have an associateship program that contains 4 key subjects. So 2 of them would be studied at an accredited university and 2 of them would be studied directly with the Actuaries Institute. And then there's 1 further year of work experience. And then the new fellowship program, which we currently call Part 3, will be 3 modules with 1 year of work experience. Of course, there's the ongoing CPD requirement as well once you've reached associateship or fellowship. Now, for most of you in the room, you've done the existing Part 2 program, so you'll be doing the existing Part 3 fellowship program that we have at the moment, rather than the new fellowship program here. So the foundation program, as I said, it's delivered at universities. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because it won't really impact you, and it's 7 subjects now. The associateship program. So this is where it's a little bit different, and I think most of you have been through Part 1 and Part 2, but for those of you who haven't, the new associateship program has the 2 exemptions at university. One's called Core Actuarial Management. It's probably split across 2 university subjects. And the other exemption is Core Data and Statistical Analysis. So what we've worked hard to do is bring more data and business acumen and communication skills into the associateship level program, because that's what our employers have been asking for. So you can get those exemptions from any of our 8 accredited universities. And then there are 2 subjects delivered by the institute, and they're delivered in an online format. One is asset management, and that replaces the study currently done in part 2 in investment and asset modelling, and a new one in communications modelling and professionalism. And that replaces the current professionalism workshop that we have, or the professionalism course. So this is now a 6-month subject that you do that's accessible. And then there's 1 further year of work experience. So currently, if you want to become an associate, it's 3 years of work experience, but now it's 1 year of work experience. So then we have the new fellowship program. As I said, students will be required to do 3 subjects, and there's 11 to choose from. We have transition rules in place, so they'll be able to be accessed so you can sort of work out what your situation might be, and again, it may not impact you really at all. We still offer depth in traditional areas like life insurance and general insurance if you want to study in those areas, but we're also offering some other pathways that are broader. So if you want to study in areas that are more general or in the data analytics sort of field and those sorts of things, we're starting to give you a bit more flexibility around that. There's an enhanced learning experience. So we've brought on dedicated teaching staff. Mike, Amanda and Steve are in the room and you've been introduced to them. And we'll be introducing further staff to that team as well. But we're also going to be investing in further video tutorials, learning resources, online resources, quizzes, assessments, interactive sort of tools that you can use to help you with your learning. There's also no need for travel because all of the subjects are delivered in an online format. So previously where you might have needed to travel to attend an ERM workshop or a professionalism course or a commercial actuarial practice program, you don't need to do that. You can access the course from anywhere in your own time. The cost of the new fellowship subjects, they are more individually in terms of per subject, but because you're only doing 3 of them, the overall cost of fellowship is actually slightly less than what it currently is. And if you've studied current Part 3 subjects and you want to sort of also do some of the new fellowship subjects, you can get credits for existing Part 3 subjects as well. So they all link through. We're trying to make sure that no one's disadvantaged at all with any of the changes that are coming through. So with that, I'm going to get Mike to talk a little bit more about the subjects that are offered as part of the new fellowship program, and Amanda will talk a little bit about the transition rules. Again, this is a lot of information at this point in time, so just, you know, take it in. It may not really impact you at all. More information will come out on Monday and you can consider it further and ask any questions as well. So, as I said, Mike Cullen's here, Amanda Aitken and Steve Holstein, and they're the initial people who will start to deliver these new fellowship subjects. Mike.
Thanks. Sarah. Welcome, everyone. I won't take long. It's been a long evening, and I think the important points you should have listened to is the comments from the chief examiner and the past students here and their study plans. It's a quite a difficult qualification, but not impossible. I just want to take you through quickly. I don't want to go through the detail here. I just want to talk about some of the differences that's going to happen in the new world. But remember that these subjects are going to be transitioned in over a 5-year period, and I'll show you those transitions in a moment. Slight differences, 3 modules. Module 1 runs in semester 1 only. Module 2 is in semester 2 only. And then we have a specialist module 3, which runs across both semesters. What we're changing is not where you end up as an actuary. As we mentioned, it's the same standard. So if you want to be a life insurance specialist in Australia, you will take a path and you will get to the same standard as you are today. But we're changing the journey. We're bringing on board people who are largely practice actuaries. We've had 20-odd years each of experience in consultancies, corporates, big firms, small firms, many clients advising. What we're doing is we're broadening the initial course to hopefully give students a better understanding of the core material, and then we're going to bring you up to the Part 3 level, which involves judgment and understanding and reading the questions. There's no real change in the end, but just the pathway we're taking you on. So as Sarah mentioned, there are 11 subjects that you can take, and these are going to be developed over time. For example, the life insurance, 2A, 2B, and 6A are essentially being merged into some courses. So we're changing the way we focus. 2A is about product development and Tubi's valuation, and we're swapping them around. So we're introducing a valuation course in semester one, 2019, and a product development course in semester two, 2019. So for those of you who've already studied 2A or 2B, you have this semester and all of next year to gain exemption in those courses. If you don't manage to gain those exemptions, and I'll show you in a moment that some of these courses are not the same, but we'll give you guidance on what's broadly equivalent. So we'll give you some advice on what to do. But as you can see, the new life courses, two of them come in 2019, and then the specialist comes in 2020. And we're repeating this process through all the other subjects. I'll just sort of skip, for example, to the GI. I apologize for the formatting. It's come out slightly odd. But for example, if some of you are studying, want to study general insurance, and typically about half our students do go down that route, as you can see, the new courses are not really going to come in until 2021. So there's plenty of time before this will impact on anyone. And given it's late, I just quick flick through. I presume all this is going to be online later. Yeah. Just want to give you an example here of subject equivalence. It's not saying the same one. If you pass one of these units, great, you get credit for it. So this slide is around what happens if you attempted 2A and didn't pass it by the time, by the end of 2019, then you'd be looking at to do another course. And what we'd be suggesting is if you've been studying 2A, then that course disappears. You probably want to do the life insurance and product development course. That's probably the closest one. So a lot of the material would be the same. So it's not as if we're given a new system where you're going to be seriously disadvantaged. I don't want to read through all these ones here. When you get the slides in the pack, you'll see that we've written down various options. There's wider options in the new system than the old. So you can see different pathways. You might think in your own world, what do you want to be? And then you can mix and match these subjects to fit your particular career aspirations. What I'd like to do now is hand over to Amanda, who's going to give you some brief notes on transitions.
So hopefully you're all feeling psyched about these changes now, not nervous. My first question for you is, or I'll just explain actually, there's in terms of transition from the existing structure to the new education system, students will fit into two groups, either Group A or Group B. So hands up in the room if you've already finished all of your Part 2 requirements apart from maybe the professionalism course. Okay, so most of you in the room fit into Group A. And so the rest of you, I'm assuming, are Group B, where you're still doing your Part 2. Is that right? Hands up if that sounds like you. Yep. And so my question for you would be, do you think you'll be finished your Part 2s by the end of next year? Because if that's the case, you'll be in Group A. If you've still got subjects that you haven't passed or got the right exemption level for by the end of next year, then you become a Group B student. Essentially, Group A continue along the current path. Group B basically transition into the new structure for both associateship and fellowship. So the key differences, I guess, between A and B, focusing on the fellowship component. For those of you that may fall into Group B, you'll also be interested in the changes at associateship, but I focused in here on fellowship. For Part A, so for most of you, you'll still do your four fellowship subjects. They can be a mixture, though, of the existing subjects and the new subjects that are going to be introduced. For anyone who falls into the Group B category, as Sarah and Mike have already talked about, you'll do three modules rather than four modules at the fellowship level. There's a difference in the work experience requirement. For some reason at the moment, there's not an actual work experience requirement for fellowship. There is 3 years to be an associate, but through some quirk, there's no actual requirement for fellowship. But under the new program, there's a requirement for 2 years of relevant work experience. That's 1 year for associate and then an extra year for your fellowship. And then another difference, I guess, is for Group A, for most of you, if you've done your professionalism course by the end of next year, then you don't need to go on and do the communications modelling and professionalism course. Or I guess the other way to look at that is if you haven't done your professionalism course by the end of next year, you'll instead be required to do communications modelling and professionalism. So that's something to keep in mind for those of you who may have been thinking about doing that a little bit later on. Whereas for Group B students, there will be no professionalism course option, so they'll all do the communications modelling and professionalism. So I think we've probably already covered off these, but I'll just check, or maybe just to reiterate. So you can mix and match. You can do some of the existing Part 3 subjects and some of the new fellowship subjects. Any passes that you've got already or that you may get over the next year or two will count as one subject towards either the three or four subjects you need to do in total. If you do have to repeat a module, so in the existing system there are opportunities, all of the current subjects will still be offered next year, and the aim is to allow everyone at least one resit attempt on any of the existing Part 3 subjects. And if you have failed a couple of times, most of the current subjects have a mostly equivalent new module that you can do instead. So you won't completely lose any of that knowledge that you've gained. You'll be able to transfer it into the new subject. And again, just to reiterate, if you haven't completed the professionalism course by the end of 2019, then yeah, you'll go on to do the communications modelling and professionalism module instead. So I know our new education team is feeling very excited about these changes. I hope you guys are as well, but I'm also conscious that you probably have a few questions and you'll all be in slightly different circumstances in terms of your study journey. So happy to take any questions now and over the coming weeks when you get sort of detailed information that comes out early next week.
I'm just wondering, current Part 3 basis, if I completed 2A2B and CAP and then was in a plane crash and stranded on a desert island for 5 years.
I hope that doesn't happen. So you've done 2A and 2B and CAP, and you're a Group A student, so you've finished your Part 2 by the end of 2019, then you have one more subject to do still.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So I'm very sorry about your plane crash, but you've got to study one more exam. Yep. Yep.
Actually, one of those students who is looking to do learning strengths in CEPA.
Yep.
So I passed away this semester, but I'm still about to do the other courses, one of which I believe will be 6A and I'll be 2B because of learning strengths. So then what would happen if I do 2A, 2B, or 2A and 6A, and I still fail 2B at the end of 2019? My 2A and 6A, isn't that an equivalent? Does 2A and 6A have the equivalent course, life insurance, and retirement income product development? I think it does. Right?
So let's go back to that slide then.
So, what would happen to that? Does that mean I basically did two courses and set two exams for one exam?
No, you've got two, you've passed 2A and 6A.
Yeah.
Two credits, and you have another two credits to take.
Right. But if I only did 2A and I failed 6A, then I move on to this new system,
mm-hmm.
and I did three more courses. That means
yep.
I should take life insurance and retirement product development, and then valuation, and then the specialist course in order to qualify. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, I think so.
It's an interesting question, though, because you're saying you've passed 2A, but then you're going to go on and do life insurance and retirement product development because you've already sort of studied it, so it would be easier for you. Is that what you're saying?
I don't have a choice, really, because I didn't do four courses, right? So I passed 2A and said I don't pass anything for the next year and a half.
But yep.
It's not going to happen. But then I move into the new system where
mm-hmm.
I, because of my interest, I wanted the 2A, 2B, 6A cap before.
Does yep.
that mean I really should retake life insurance and retirement product development again, which is equivalent to 2A, and then do valuation and then do my, application, or what should I do?
Yeah, so what's missing from that slide are the application subjects, because really, I guess they're equivalent to CAP. Is that on the next slide?
So does that mean yeah. I do two application subjects? Do I do, because I have 2A, which is equivalent to the product development one, and then I do life insurance and retirement valuation, and then I do life application and retirement application to get my four courses? Is that what's...
So going back to originally, before any changes,
yeah.
your idea was to do 2A and 2B
yeah.
and 6A and 6B.
So 6A and CAP.
Oh, 6A and CAP, okay. 6A
would be module one.
Yeah, 6A would be module one.
Right, and now 2A and 6A are effectively combined, yeah, you're saying, yeah. So what happens to your choices? Yep. Yeah, it's a good question, and to be honest, I think we have to think about that. I've done 2A, I've passed 2A, can I go on and do a very equivalent module again and count that as a second subject?
Because it is possible that I'll go for a constant exclusive, it is a possibility.
Yeah, and there are other options available. So there's the data analytics applications, and ERM is still an option in the new system. So there are other options, but I know what you're saying. You wanted to go down this life retirement path. Yeah. What does that do to your choices, given that some of them have been combined? So, I think that's a really good question. So I think we probably need...
If you've passed 2A, I think that's going to exclude you from doing the course. It's almost the same. We're not going to allow you to take 2A. It's replacement. 2B. It's replacement. It's going to be a very easy way.
And you're not learning a lot extra. Yeah.
So I just have to pick another one from the first list.
Yes.
Okay, so I've got me, take 2A, 6A. Well, me and Matthew are both in that situation.
Yeah, and that's two anagrams.
But I would have the choice to pick two applications, like life insurance and retirement applications.
So then you do one application.
You only need to do one application.
Yes, but I understand, but I need to do four courses, right? So I have to choose either an investment or ERM, but I can choose two applications.
And for particularly for you, because we're introducing the new life and retirement next year, you've got less time to, I guess, finish off the other ones you're planning. Yep.
Thinking from what you're going to put in with insurance and superannuation, does that sit within life insurance or within superannuation? Because there's not a lot of life insurance actually because over superannuation.
Yeah, thank you. And it is really helpful to have these questions because we think we've gone through all the different scenarios, but sometimes there is one we hadn't thought of, so it's very useful. Thanks. Okay.
Hi. So I've finished my part two exam and I'm just going the part three exam, the IM subject based assessment. So am I in the part? Group A or Group B?
Yep, so you finished your part twos.
Yeah.
Yep, so you're in Group A.
Okay, so that means I need to do
four fellowship, yep. And that can be a combination of the current and the new, yep.
Okay. I just like to say I'm pretty excited about this new program. It's really one of the pathways to become a fellowship. Because you get the lot of nothing not work in the traditional life or general insurance industry. So just in relation, I'm quite interested in data analytics subjects. And so when will that become available?
So from 2020, the data analytics... you're talking about the data analytics applications?
Is that the only one related to data analytics?
So there is a new associateship level subject that's coming in, but for you, I guess you're talking about the data analytics applications, yep, which is... Remember the...
Yes. Okay, so in 2022, there will be a Part 3 data analytics course, but also in 2020, it doesn't affect you, we're having data analytics courses in the universities. There is a potential pathway for somebody who's a Group A student to elect to become a Group B student by taking the data analytics course in the university.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But that's in 2020. 2020. Yep.
Yeah. Anyone got any other questions? Otherwise, you can go home and process all of this and think about the questions you want to ask.
So thank you everyone for attending. For those of you who are still in the room, we will have pizza and drinks and obviously the opportunity to speak to everybody here if you have any further questions. For those of you online, thank you very much for joining us. If you do think of any questions or have any further comments, please feel free to email the education team. Thank you all.